Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guests are Scott Onstott and Randall Carlson. So Randall just asked us over the break, Scott, could I recap in 15 seconds what we've been talking about? And I said, nah, bro, I can't, eh? Take us about an hour and a half. But anyway, what I wanted to do is just have a kind of a conversation between Randall and Scott. And I think the last thing we were talking about was how knowing about measurements and geometry and mathematics and things of that nature affects your perspective on spirituality and what it actually is. Randall, what would your opinion be?
Well, okay, on the matter of... That's the kind of thing I should ponder for a minute. But in the instance of interest of time here, I'll say that measurement clearly relates to geometry. And one of the things that I think that we find when we begin to study measurement is that it was held in very high regard by ancient cultures. And in fact, when we think about the, I may have even gotten this from Scott, the idea that a ruler is an implement of measure, right? But it is also the ruler of the kingdom, right? And the idea was is that the ruler, the measuring stick, the cubit, the rod, the staff was an implement of power that the king was able to wield. And in a sense, it was. In my business as a builder, I certainly know the importance of good measure. And, the Bible, plus a lot of other spiritual writings, are full of references to the importance of good measure. But once we get into the specifics of it, what we discover is that all throughout the ancient world, there seems to be a whole set of interconnections amongst all these various units of measurement, and they all can be synthesized into a systematic whole through the medium of geometry. So, in many of the visionary writings of the Bible, the prophecies and so forth, what do we find? That the prophet is confronted by a man, sometimes an angel, who holds a measuring line or a measuring rod in his hand. And I think part of the reason for that is because we have this idea of dynamic symmetry infused throughout all of the material universe, and it's reflected of patterns that perhaps we can't see visibly, but are reflected through the nature of space and time. Because as we've talked about before, one of the things that interests me is how we apply these patterns, if you will, to the measurement of time as well as space. So something that's intrigued me for many years is temporal periodicities, and how, we tend to look at time in the modern context is basically purely a linear phenomenon. And I think that comes from sort of the Judeo-Christian concept that there was a definite point of creation, and then there will be a final moment of destruction, it's called Judgment Day or whatever. And so there's a beginning and an end, and it's proceeding forward in this linear fashion, whereas in the ancient models of time, it was cyclical, and there were cycles within cycles, smaller cycles, just as our daily cycle is subsumed within the larger cycle of the year. The year was conceived as being contained within larger cycles, and those in turn in larger cycles. And so we've inherited this concept of the great year, which I consider to be the model of all prophecy, because, basically the prophet is the one who was able to take the long view. I used the analogy with somebody earlier today that, here in Georgia, it's now, 2nd of May, and if your memory only went back for 2 weeks, you would have a concept of the way the world was, right? And you wouldn't understand the concept of winter, right? You wouldn't understand, or if your entire framework of reference was limited to only July for 1 month, and your memory didn't go past that, you wouldn't have a concept of winter. But someone who had a longer view, whose memory went back a full year, would understand the cyclic nature of time, and by knowing what had transpired in the past, one can make intelligent predictions about what is likely to transpire in the future. And I tend to think that that's the basis of prophecy, is that you have access to this domain of information about the longer, the larger cycles of change. And, you know, we have a scientific model. Geologists look at it and have now decided that there are, seems to be cycles of change. You know, in the last 2.6 million years, roughly, we've oscillated back and forth between glacial and interglacial ages. You know, astronomers look at the larger celestial domain around us and see that everything is orbiting and everything has a periodicity to it. You know, looking at on atomic and molecular frequencies, it appears that there's a cyclic nature to the thing. Now, I think that what we might be approaching here is the idea that there is a kind of a harmonic resonance between all these domains of scale, so that things are vibrating on a smaller... For example, the distance between an electron and the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, if you scaled that up, it would be roughly the distance from the sun to the Oort cloud, which is the cloud of comets that surrounds the sun. So,
can I offer something here?
Of course.
All right, I was just thinking as you're saying this. Have you ever seen those mechanical models of the solar system? You know, Pluto's got its specific orbit and it runs around at a certain rate, and Earth goes around at a certain, you know.
Yes,
and so they're all going out of control, sort of. It seems like, but every now and again they align. And I was just thinking about that as an analogy for, say, human existence. Let's say there's certain aspects of human culture and human life that go round and then come back again. And occasionally there's big alignments where everything's all happening at once. And a lot of people have said that we're kind of living in that time of alignment, like the potential energy for both good and evil is at its highest that it's really ever been.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do seem to be living in accelerated times. I mean, you know, we can look at large periods of history and see that for the majority of the human race within recorded history, the world that they, you know, when they reached their old age and the world that they passed away from wasn't a whole lot different from the world that they were born into. And, you know, for the majority of the human population, typically they lived their lives within, you know, a 10 to 20 mile radius of where they were born. And the world didn't change much. Of course, there have been these episodes of concentrated change, obviously, and we're certainly in one right now. I mean, you know, I mean, I will always recall my grandfather telling me that, you know, well, when I was a little boy, there were no airplanes. We hadn't taken to the air yet, you know. And, of course, I came along in the mid-century, and there was no space. We had no space program, you know, when I was a little kid. We had no satellites, you know. Now, when we think about what satellites, the fact that you're sitting here in New Zealand, and I'm up here in the southeastern United States, talking to each other real time and looking at each other, I mean, this was inconceivable 40 and 50 years ago. So, I mean, clearly the pace of change has accelerated from what it was.
And when I was a little kid, Randall, we didn't have personal computers. So that's, you know, in my lifetime, obviously, we have this wonderful invention, Skype, that allows us to connect all across the planet. And I don't think we even understand the implications of that yet. Like, what is that really going to do for us? You know, in the long term. I wanted to point something out.
Could I just say one thing before you continue, Scott? Humanity kind of needs to evolve with the technology, and I think what happens is when the technology comes into play, it forces an evolutionary change in how we act and how we communicate and how we build our society, doesn't it?
Yes. Randall agrees.
I agree.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, Scott, you were saying?
Oh, just that I recently went to Venice, and there's a beautiful clock there in St. Mark's Square that it's a 24-hour dial, and it has the all the zodiac constellations, so you can see where the sun is, in which sign, at what time of day, and it also tracks the movement of the moon through the zodiac. And I just thought that was brilliant because it gives everybody there in Venice the notion of cyclical time, because the arm on the clock basically shows you where you are in Earth's rotation, and it ties you in with the influences of the planets and the whole astrology. And so I thought that was a really interesting way of depicting time. It emphasizes the interconnection with the solar system and the movement of the Earth, which is something that has sort of been forgotten and broken with digital watches and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The clock is a symbol to me. The clock with the 12 hours on it is a symbol for the year with the 12 months and the great year with the 12 ages. I don't ever look at a clock where I'm not reminded of, you know, the grander cycles that have the same tempo, but on a much larger scale. Yes, very much.
That was something we talked about earlier in the show, Randall, is how life is built upon life, infinitely up in scale and infinitely down in scale, just like geometry is built upon geometry, infinitely up in scale and down in scale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. All the structures of the atoms have similar structures to the solar system, and the solar system's got similar structure to the greater galaxy, and so on, yes. And so forth.
Yeah, I don't know if you caught that analogy that I used between the electron and the outer shell of the that occupies the outer shell relative to the nucleus. But that to me is a very interesting relationship, because, you know, certainly when we talk about the solar system, most people think of, you know, out to the outer planets, but it actually extends much, much further than that and includes this gigantic zone of cometary material that was left over from the creation of the solar system. And it would appear now that this zone of material, the cometary material, has played a very profound role in the evolution of life on this planet. You've probably heard of the emerging science of exobiology, which is basically theorizing that life did not actually originate on Earth, but originated elsewhere in the universe, and was delivered to this planet by, most likely, the most effective instrument for the delivery of life would be comets. And the Oort cloud is a shell of comets that surrounds our solar system out to several light years, almost halfway to the nearest star systems, which are about 4.3 light years away. And then within the Oort cloud, you have the Kuiper disk, or Kuiper belt, which is another zone of comets, which lies more or less in the plane of the planets. But the Kuiper disk and the Oort cloud are both essential parts of the whole solar system. And we can't talk about the solar system without realizing that there's this outer zone of matter and energy that's going on. And the Oort cloud can be affected by things, modulated by things that are on the galactic level, so that galactic perturbations can cause dislodging of the Oort cloud comets, which are in a quasi-stable state, and send them on an inward journey where they will come in and pass the zone of the planets and eventually approach the sun. And likewise, with the Kuiper disk, the inner zone of the Kuiper disk will be perturbed by conjunctions of the large outer planets, which can send comets careening into the inner solar system, where they would then become potentially Earth crossers and could affect life on Earth, either through direct impacts or by littering the inner solar system with the byproducts of their disintegration. And because of the fact that the perturbations of the comets are governed by the tempo of the planetary orbits, there could be right there the suggestion of a synchrony between the periodicities of the planets and the delivery schedule of comets to the inner solar system, where they can basically do their work of affecting evolution.
So there's an analogy I thought of when you're discussing that, Randall, of how a comet could bring the building blocks of life to the planet, and it's very much like a sperm bringing the code to the egg.
Yes, it's an incredible metaphor there, because there's a lot of similarities, even just the visual appearance. But also in a way, you know, when the spermatozoan enters the egg, there's a response in the egg that basically, and I'm not sure how the biology of this works, but it prevents the further incursion of other spermatozoan. And I think that in effect, we are sort of, humans could possibly be like the sort of the biological counterpart in that we could provide a planetary defense system. But I think that basically, if there are planets throughout the galaxy, the halfway mark of a planet would essentially be when life has evolved to the point where it could actually leave the host planet. And I sort of look at that right now, that planet Earth is at the halfway point, because for hundreds of millions of years, planet has been subject and vulnerable to these sweeping cosmic destructions imposed upon the planet from outside the cosmic domain. And unlike the dinosaurs, we humans now can actually do something to prevent that further process from occurring, the mass extinctions and the devastation of habitat and so forth that has occurred throughout the history of the planet. And that could, in the long run, be our redemption.
You know, ironically, Randall, I think that actually we're accelerating our extinction rather than developing the ability to prevent it in a lot of ways. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Randall Carlson and Scott Onstott are my guests. Back in a minute.